you can see what we're talking about tonight. It's mostly two big things, the implications of action and then getting into the Robinson Crusoe economy. Okay, so hope you guys have been able to do the reading. If I haven't stressed it before, let me just say again, it will help you a lot if you do the reading that's assigned for each week before that Wednesday, so you can hear the lecture having done the reading, because then the lecture will make more sense to you. It's not the end of the world if you don't, but especially as we get into the harder material, it's really going to help you if you've done it once and grappled with it, and then I'm there to just clarify the stuff that you were confused by, as opposed to you hearing it for the first time from me and then going and doing the reading. All right, so this first slide, action is a viewpoint. Let me just clarify what I mean by that phrase, and to give you an incentive, this is something that's on the quiz for this week, so pay attention. What I mean here is that what I'm trying to stress to you guys is that as economists, at least in the tradition of Ludwig von Mises, which is what I've been doing for the textbook, and that's what I'm giving you in this class, what I'm trying to get you to see is that what social scientists do, generally speaking, and what economists in particular do, is they are interpreting people's actions, or I should say behavior, as conscious, goal-seeking action. All right, so that, and let me just make sure you get that, because on one hand, it's almost like trivial. It's almost like, well, okay, that's fine, but what's the big deal? Why are you wasting so much time? This is basic stuff. Everyone knows that once you spell out what you're talking about. But on the other hand, it's actually very significant, and so that's why I'm taking the time to go over this, to make sure you get this, because it's important, again, tying in with last week's lecture, it's important for you to understand what we're doing in economics. I mean, because we're going to get into the economics. In fact, in this lecture, halfway through, we're going to get into economics in terms of Robinson Crusoe. Right? But I wanted to really lay the foundation for you guys so you understand what is it that we're doing? What is economics? And so I subscribe to the views of the Austrian economist following the tradition of Mises, saying that economics, what it really is, it's a branch of knowledge or human inquiry or a discipline that looks at the fact that human beings engage in action, meaning goal-seeking, rational behavior, with what the, you know, we have to be careful what we mean by those terms, and that there's a lot you can derive from that insight. Okay, so when I say action is a viewpoint, the person who's doing the viewing is the social scientist, is the economist. That we are looking at the world, and one way we can interpret it is to say, huh, maybe I can make sense of all this stuff going around by assuming or by hypothesizing or operating under the assumption of that there are other minds out there at work. And that's different. So a physicist doesn't adopt action as a viewpoint. A physicist adopts mechanical laws as a viewpoint and says, well, I'm looking out at the world, and the way I make sense of all the stuff that's happening is I say, actually, all these things that look like they're big solid objects, really, they're composed of mostly empty space, and in fact, there's real little particles, and maybe they're not even particles, maybe they're just concepts and probabilities and so forth. And there's, you know, they're made of molecules, and the molecules are made of atoms and so on. And what governs the behavior of these atoms or their constituent parts? Well, I have these general laws that I can express mathematically, and there's various forces, let's call them. There's a gravitational force, and there's the electrical force, and blah, blah, blah. See, and that's the way the physicist explains things. So the physicist does not have any recourse to saying, oh, the reason that rock fell was because it wanted to get to the ground, and it thought that was a good way to do it, was to go through that portion of the atmosphere. That's not how a physicist talks. Okay? Whereas an economist trying to explain why did the price of apples go up yesterday might say, oh, well, the consumers wanted, their demand for apples went up because that report came out saying that if you eat apples, that you won't get cancer. And then, you know, you start telling the story that way. Okay, so that's perfectly fine for an economist to start invoking motivations and goals and preferences when the economist is trying to make sense of reality, of the outside world. Whereas for a physicist, that would be nonsense talk, at least the way we think, you know, physics should proceed nowadays. Okay, so that's what I mean. So this phrase, action as a viewpoint, I am saying it is the economist who says the way I'm going to proceed is to say that there are beings out there that have minds just like I do, and that's what they're trying to do, and that's the foundation. Okay, so that's what I mean by action as a viewpoint. That's the way we proceed as social sciences scientists. And it's not so much that people would object to that, I think, people who didn't care for Ludwig von Mises and the way he does economics. It's not so much that they would disagree, but I think they don't realize it themselves, and they don't see the implications of it. All right, so now moving on to the next slide, implications of action. And here's where I really want to drive home what I said in the previous lecture. Because remember, the previous lecture, I spent a lot of time trying to distinguish the social sciences from the natural sciences. And I said one of the big differences is, at least the way I think of economics, and I think you'll agree with me once we, you know, get into it, I can show you, that we're not going to, in this class, when I teach you economic principles, and I try to show you different ways of understanding the economy and how does the world work in terms of economics, I'm not going to be referring to experimentally tested laws or relationships between empirical magnitudes the way in physics. You know, in physics, they'll probably just teach you what the laws of physics are, but if you pressed them and said, well, how do we know that that's the law, they would say, well, because they've done experiments. And, you know, and they probably even teach you maybe some of the history of the famous experiments establishing what's the charge on an electron or that kind of thing. And yeah, the astronauts went to the moon and they took a feather and a hammer and they let go and they fell at the same rate and hit the ground at the same time, showing that, yes, our understanding of the laws of gravitation are at least approximately correct. And the reason on Earth when you drop a hammer and a feather, the hammer goes faster than the feather is because of air friction. Okay, but it's not because gravity pulls, well, it is that it pulls the hammer harder because it's more mass, but the counterbalances, the acceleration is the same. Okay, and we can test that because on the moon they did it when there's no atmosphere and a hammer and a feather drops at the same acceleration. Okay, so that's what I'm saying, that there, when you're trying to understand in physics or even biology or chemistry, if you just question your teacher, your professor or something in an introductory undergrad class, like, well, how do we know this isn't just a bunch of gobbledygook? They could ultimately say, well, you know, we've done experiments. I mean, they've tested this stuff in the lab. They know that this is, we can't say it's for sure or we can't say it's right for sure, but every time we've checked it, that's the way it's turned out. And so if we think nature is governed by a simple set of laws, it looks like we're at least close to what those laws are. Whereas in economics, certainly at the principles level, the stuff we're doing this course, that's not at all the way I'm going to justify what I'm doing to you. Mostly what we're going to be doing is just thinking through various scenarios. And that sounds odd. It would be like telling stories and just thinking through the ramifications of the assumptions we make and say, well, what if someone were in this kind of scenario, what would that person do? And then we just start reasoning that way. And it's almost as if it seems like that's too easy. That's not scientific. And that's what I'm trying to get you to see, is that no, it actually is the way economics ought to proceed. And that you're fooling yourself if you think to make economics rigorous and scientific, it's got to look like physics. And I think that explains why economics went down the wrong path in the 20th century. Okay, so that's just repeating a lot from last lecture. Now coming to today. Remember, I ended that last lecture saying a good model for economics, at least in the development of principles, is geometry, where you start from some simple definitions or axioms, and then you spin out logical conclusions like the Pythagorean theorem. So now that's what I'm going to try to do here and show you, if we just start from the assumption or the axiom or the starting point that there are people out there that engage in purposeful behavior, that they use their minds to try to achieve goals, that there's a lot packed into that. If you agree with me that that statement is true, well, then there's a lot of things that that commits you to that you can deduce from it. Just like if you agree with me on the definition of a right triangle and you agree with me that, you know, rearranging the pieces of a square isn't going to change the area of the interior and that kind of stuff, well, then I can prove to you the Pythagorean theorem, even though when you were agreeing with me that, oh, yeah, okay, that's what a triangle is, I buy that, and so forth, you didn't know the Pythagorean theorem when you were agreeing to that stuff. But then I demonstrate to you, nope, just using your mind now, step by step, see, the Pythagorean theorem has to be true if you've already agreed to these other things. So that's the idea. So by analogy with that, that's what we're going to do right now, is try to show you that if you agree with me that, yes, for certain purposes at least, as an economist, it makes sense to look out at the world and say, the way I'm going to make sense of this is that I think there are other minds at work out there, people trying to achieve their own ends. There's a lot of things that spill out right away. Okay, so why don't we walk through some of those. So next slide, only individuals act. So this one is pretty straightforward, but and so the idea is when you're talking about action, that you need to, the mind that is the thing doing the deciding, or the acting, is just one separate entity, and you don't want to be mixing different people up, okay? So the easiest way to get this point across, because you might say, well, what else would it be, is just to show that people don't talk like this a lot. A lot of times people will say things like, oh, the United States began invading Afghanistan after 9/11, or Saudi Arabia cut oil production after the OPEC meetings to try to raise oil prices. And that's the way we talk a lot in the modern political context, where it makes it look like an entire country is doing something. And that's kind of sloppy language. That no, it's various officials in the U.S. government ordered other people in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines to carry out certain operations, and then particular individuals were flying bombers and released their bombs or whatever. Okay, you get the idea that it's a little bit more nuanced. Or to even say something like, the crowd was enraged and hanged the man they thought was the murderer. You know, they threw a rope around the tree and hanged him, and the crowd killed the guy. Well, I mean, yeah, that's true in a sense, but really what we mean is individuals in that group decided, you know, some of them decided, well, at least one person decided, I'm going to pick up this rope, tie it into a noose, and throw it over the branch, and other people were deciding, I'm going to clap and say, yeah, get him, because that sounds like a good idea to me. I think that guy's guilty, and he deserves it. All right, so the action that we're witnessing that looks like a collective acting is actually individuals acting. Now, let me clarify, as an economist, to make this observation, you're not saying the collectives don't exist, okay? Yeah, so I'm not saying that there's no such thing as a crowd. Of course there's a crowd. We can define what does crowd mean. It means a group of people or a lot of people or whatever. And does that sometimes happen? Yeah, sure. At a football game, there's a crowd. There's no doubt about that. So I'm not denying that crowds exist. What I'm saying, though, is if you're going to try to use action to explain things, if you're going to try to say people have means to try to achieve ends, you have to be careful and precise, and that the crowd doesn't want anything, because the crowd is not an individual actor, right? There's no mind of the crowd. If you want to say the crowd got really loud, or the crowd went nuts when the home team scored the winning touchdown, I mean, it's not that the crowd had goals, okay? It's that individuals in the crowd had goals, and then, or a lot of them did, that the people root for the home team, and then when the person scored, each person, you can explain, decided that he preferred to jump up and down yelling and screaming rather than sitting glumly in the chair, okay? So you'd still explain the outcome by reference to the decisions of the individuals composing the crowd. So another thing is, not only do do I acknowledge that crowds exist, I also acknowledge that individuals might behave, or should say act differently, depending on whether they're in a crowd or whether they're by themselves. Okay, so, you know, we're not, as economists who are insisting on this aspect of individualism here, we're not saying that, oh, the sociologists and so forth are all wet, and there's no such thing as peer pressure, and there's no such thing as mob psychology. No, that stuff is all true. All we're saying is, ultimately, if you are going to try to explain social phenomena by reference to the fact that there's goal-seeking action going on, that you need to be very careful and say that, and not use sloppy language like the crowd wanted to do something, that doesn't really make sense. Okay, so that's the modest point we're making. So yes, it's true, you take a bunch of people and put them together and give them some alcohol in particular, they're more likely to go lynch somebody than if you just have individual people, you know, that no one person is probably going to go and try to kill somebody on his own, and not even just because of the physical challenge of it, but that people get riled up when they're in a crowd and they think that they're just one part of many and 99 other people are doing something you feel less responsibility for. All right, so that's all real, and no one's denying that. But the point is still, if the crowd goes and takes the law into their own hands and hangs somebody that they think is a murderer, it's still ultimately, as a social scientist, you have to explain why is it that those individuals decided to act in that way. And maybe part of the explanation is they didn't feel it was immoral since all these other people around them were doing it. And so it lulled them into thinking it was okay. All right, so that's fine. Now, as far as, you know, well, gee, Dr. Murphy, is this just some little pet peeve you have and you just want to be real anal about this sort of thing? No, it's not just that. I mean, there are definite mistakes people make in their analysis of even narrowly economic issues because they don't obey this principle. So to give you a specific example, a lot of times you'll hear people ranting against the government. Oh, yeah, the government's so stupid. The government doesn't know what it's doing. I mean, just to give you an example of what I mean, you've got the same government that is spending all this money on anti-smoking ads, you know, trying to teach kids in grade school that cigarettes are going to kill them and all that kind of stuff. That same government gives subsidies to tobacco farmers. So that just shows how irrational the government is. Okay, so, yeah, it's important to point that out to people who think that the government is this great social force that's keeping kids from off cigarettes when you say, well, you know, that same government subsidizes tobacco farmers, so isn't that kind of weird? I mean, so it's important to point out that inconsistency, but notice there is no inconsistency. The only inconsistency is if you think there's this monolithic entity called the U.S. government that has a mind of its own and has desires. Well, then that's a little bit weird that it's telling, you know, that it's subsidizing anti-smoking education and it's subsidizing tobacco farmers at the same time. It's hard to come up with why is that rational if one person were, you know, if one rich person were doing both things, that would be a little bit weird. And you would suspect that, you know, that there was something else behind the story there. But the fact that the U.S. government's doing it, that's not surprising at all, because the various politicians and bureaucrats and other people who are involved with those decisions, each individual decision makes perfect sense. So the senators and congress people who are from the states that have the tobacco farmers, of course they're going to vote for the subsidies because that's good for their constituents and helps them get reelected. But then the other people who are like maybe from California or something and are real big on public health issues, and they come from districts where the people are big on the government needs to do things to keep our kids drug free and all that, well, they could easily and consistently vote for money to be spent in the public school system teaching kids not to smoke. And also, if it funnels money into the school system, then maybe, you know, the teachers unions like that. All right, so there's no inconsistency there once you realize that it's that there's no such thing as a being called the U.S. government that has a mind of its own and that is making decisions, that's not you know, that metaphor breaks down when you take it too literally. Okay, the next slide is that individuals have preferences. So here, and again, all these things that I'm going over now are saying these are implications of the fact that people act. Okay, that when we say the word act, we mean in the specific technical sense that they are trying to achieve ends. Okay, so individuals have preferences. Well, that again follows because if you're looking out the world and you're saying as an economist, the way I'm going to try to start making sense of all this to come up with some general principles or a framework to help me grapple with all this crazy stuff that goes on all every day as an economist, I'm going to say that I see people trying to achieve things and they're trying to, you know, they have goals. Well, then that means they must have preferences. It means there must be the people involved that you're saying have goals and that are acting, it must be that they prefer the world to be one way rather than another. Okay, that it matters to them how things unravel through time. Because if it didn't matter to them, then why are they acting? All right. And again, when I'm using that word acting, you probably all know this, but let me just state again so I'm not losing anybody up front. Of course, I don't mean acting like Robert De Niro is an actor. Okay, that's not the sense in which I'm using the verb to act here. I mean act that somebody is engaging in purposeful behavior. They're trying to achieve something. And so that when we see that, so the rock falling, we don't interpret that as the rock trying to achieve something, whereas a guy jumping out of a plane with a parachute on, we interpret that as, oh yeah, there's somebody trying to achieve something with that. Okay, and that's the way we explain the situation if we attribute intentionality to it. So here again, making the very modest point on this slide that if you are going to walk around as a social scientist and start using the hypothesis that there are acting agents out there in the world, and that's one way you start understanding what's going on, well then it just follows automatically that those acting agents must have preferences. They must care, they must value, if you will, certain things more than others, that they have certain ways that they would prefer the world go than a different possible path, because that's why they're acting to try to influence how events unfold. So if you didn't have preferences, if you didn't care one way or the other, well then it wouldn't make sense for us to try to explain the movements of your body by saying, oh, you're trying to achieve something. Because to say you're trying to achieve a goal means you must prefer that the achievement of that goal to the failure to achieve that goal. All right? So I realize this stuff, it almost sounds childish, like, well, no duh, but we're just spelling out. And just to say, oh, people are engaged in goal-seeking behavior, that statement by itself, I didn't say anything about preferences. Okay, but you see what I'm saying here? So it's not, just let me make sure you understand what we're doing here. We're not going out and testing. We're not saying, go round up 1,000 people that are engaged in goal-seeking behavior and then ask them, hey, do you guys have preferences? That's not what we're doing here. What we're saying is, logically, if you're going to explain a situation by saying there is an agent that is acting and trying to achieve ends, well, then you have to also think, logically, that that agent has preferences and that values some outcomes more than others. Because otherwise, it makes no sense to say that that agent is trying to achieve something or is engaged in goal-seeking behavior. Okay, next slide. Preferences are subjective. And so here, what I mean is just the modest point that, you know, we've already established that agents, individuals, have preferences, but so far, we haven't said anything about whether they all have the same preferences. And so here we're just acknowledging that those preferences are peculiar or specific to each of the individual actors. All right. And so here I'm just saying that, you know, some people like Madonna, other people like Sinatra. In terms of politicians, some people like George W. Bush, some people like Ron Paul. And some people don't understand why I like Carrot Top. Okay, so that's what I'm getting at here, that if you're trying to, just to continue with this example, if you're trying to explain why people are going into these, you know, on a certain Tuesday in November, you're just looking at the world, and man, what's going on? All of these four-limbed creatures, or mostly four-limbed creatures, are getting into these metal things, and they're moving towards these locations scattered all around, and they get out, and then they go into these things, and they pull a curtain behind them, and they do something with their hand, and they walk, what's going on? And you say, oh, they're voting, it's election day, and they're trying to, various factions are trying to make their candidate win the election. All right, and so there you're explaining all these bodily movements by reference to goal-seeking behavior. Okay, so they're just walking through. So you get the point there, that as economists or social scientists in general, that's how we start explaining things, is that we start attributing motives to people. And now what I'm saying is another little aspect of that is the fact that, you know, people are, if you're trying to explain various people's behaviors by reference to the motives that they have, realize that there's nothing guaranteeing that those motives are all going to be the same, that people are going to have different goals. Or if we're talking in the language of preferences, people are going to care or value things differently. And so that's why preferences are subjective. That's all we mean. So that if you're trying to explain why is this guy going in the poll and pulling the lever for Ron Paul and this other guy's going in and pulling it for his opponent, well, it's perfectly fine as a social scientist to say, oh, well, because this guy wants Ron Paul to be president and this guy doesn't. And that's, there's nothing wrong with talking like that. That's perfectly scientific, if you will, to start out from that and to say people have different preferences. That's the way you get going. As an economist, if you're trying to explain consumer prices, let's say, and you're trying to explain why is the price of this particular flavor of ice cream different from this other price over here, or, you know, why is the price of steak more than the price of hamburger? And you start going through those things. I mean, you're going to involve the fact that consumers have preferences, and sometimes you may have to cite the fact that, well, not everybody likes that thing. Only a few people like this particular item, and that's going to influence the analysis, and that's how you're going to explain the objective market prices. You're going to ultimately rely on the fact, for some explanations, that some consumers like this product and other ones don't, and that's perfectly fine. Now let me explain to you that this is a touchy topic, okay? And so there's a lot of people, because what this ties into is what's called subjective value theory. So we're not gonna throw that sound around a lot, or that term around a lot, because I don't want to use intimidating language, and we're not going to get into it too much. But what I want to say is that a lot of conservative people, they hear economists just teaching modern price theory, and the economist will say, and so now we have the subjective theory of value. Or they might, like in this, like I got this slide, say preferences are subjective, and that's like going to send off warning bells for a lot of modern political conservatives, because they're going to say, whoa, 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 are you like a moral relativist? Are you saying there's no such thing as absolute truth? Are you saying that, you know, I can't claim that it is objectively wrong to go kill somebody, or that, you know, there's no difference between whether marriages are between two people or between a bunch of people, you know, and you're saying we have to say everything is equally valid and we can't make any value judgments on anybody else's lifestyle? Is that what you're saying? And no, this has nothing to do with that. Okay, when an economist says preferences are subjective, all he or she is meaning is that to explain individual actions, and in particular, if you want to start talking about why prices are what they are and start talking about consumer behavior and producer behavior in the marketplace, you have to just acknowledge the basic fact that people have different preferences.